Welcome to another episode of Bitches Love Sports. Woo-hoo. I'm Bitch 2.
I'm Bitch 3.
And we have with us a special guest today, a very special guest, a beloved member of the roller derby community. She was a member of BGGW, that is Bad Girl Good Woman Productions. She was a member of the Rhinestone Cowgirls from 2001 to 2002. And she was one of the founding members of Texas Roller Girls in 2003. A Texecutioner from 2003 to 2008, retiring at the end of the 2009 season as a Jammer Pivot. And she is also the person who designed the track, the flat track, that a lot of us who are listening to this skate on in 2002. And so that's what's currently being used by the WFTDA with permission, of course. And her name is, if you haven't figured it out yet, it's Electra Blue. And she's right here, sorry we don't have like a cool curtain to like unveil who this awesome person is. But she's contributed a lot as far as the development of the roller derby community, and she's remained involved for a long time as an announcer. Anything else you want to add to your intro?
I mean, that ain't good. I sent all that to you, so that's good. And of course, you know, all the business and all the boring stuff. And, the skating zone is the fun part.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We're going to dive into some of the boring stuff and some of the exciting stuff later. But first, we do want to do a few shout-outs and call-outs, like usual. I don't even know if I want to call them shout-outs and call-outs today. It's more like just commentary on what's happening in the sports world right now. I always say that sports is a 24-hour news cycle, and today is a great example of that. Mm-hmm. Because yesterday, we recorded and talked about the Saints, the Cowboys, and the Sooners mostly, and that was fine. And then all of a sudden today, you have all these storylines pop up. I know you've been following one of them, what's been going on with Aaron Rodgers.
It's a doozy. I'm very concerned about this.
So Aaron Rodgers is not going to be available to practice with his team for at least 10 days mm-hmm. because he tested positive for COVID. And for a lot of people, this is our first time even realizing that he's not vaccinated. Not necessarily saying that it's our business, but throughout the season, there are a lot of players who have been criticized for not being vaccinated and the impact that it might have on their team. And here's a very beloved member of the NFL community who is not vaccinated. It is going to impact his team for very likely 2 games in a row. And a lot of people are wondering if this is the true basis of the back and forth he had with the Green Bay Packers during the offseason. If a lot of it had less to do with what he claimed about the treatment of ownership and more to do with his desire to just not get the vaccine. Mm-hmm. Because he even tried to negotiate with them, and we're not sure what the procedure was, but he went through some sort of process or procedure that he said made him immunized. Yes. And that should count as vaccination.
Yes.
And like I said, I don't know what it was, but he's clearly not immune. He has COVID now. Now, whether or not that process is, you know, makes one more likely to come down with COVID than the actual vaccine, I don't know. Have no idea what it was. But that's something that he tried to do. And the team reportedly told him, no, that doesn't count. You don't have the vaccine. We're going to treat you as a non-vaccinated player. And the process that they have to go through, the protocols that non-vaccinated players have to go through, is different than that for vaccinated mm-hmm. players. But one of the things that the team did allow, they allowed him to appear in person at press conferences, whereas other unvaccinated players, they did not allow that. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the major talking points for today, with people trying to figure out why that exception was made, how much of this had to do with their back and forth during the offseason and everything else.
Yeah, I think the fact that he shared with the press, well, I'm immunized. And I think that for a lot of people, they thought that meant vaccinated. And so like knowing that he is now unvaccinated and caught COVID, I mean, I think some people don't have all the background information and they're shocked, because using those words, not using the term vaccinated, but using something very similar to that can be like very confusing, especially right now.
Yes, there is so much. I won't even say there's a lot of misinformation out right now. It's more like you have the information and then you have something that's a cross between conspiracy theories and just willful ignorance, I guess you could say. And so this is one of those things that definitely adds to it, because as we've discussed, a lot of people will look for things to justify their fear of the vaccine, or they'll look for reasons to doubt it. And if you have a person that they trust,
even though, you know, what makes him qualified? Nothing. He's an NFL quarterback. That does not make him a medical professional or make him any smarter than anyone else who's out here giving information about the vaccine. But people trust him. Mm-hmm. I saw a post that said one of the issues with vaccine hesitancy in the U.S. is the fact that we've developed a medical system where, in order to avoid crushing debt, people will go to the internet to find solutions for their ailments. And so the same thing is happening with COVID. It's become part of the culture when it comes to health and wellness. And so I don't think Aaron Rodgers intended for things to play out this way. But I do think even if something isn't your responsibility, other people's medical choices are not your responsibility, you do have to at least understand that the impact that you might have on people whenever it comes to information that they may or may not accept. And you have to be responsible about that.
Absolutely.
So with it being that I don't speak too much on people's personal business, that's all I have to say about that. I hope Aaron Rodgers gets well soon. And I hope the Packers figure out a way to still get the W in his absence. One other story I heard about today was Scottie Pippen. Scottie Pippen's coming out with a book, and it kind of seems like ever since the Last Dance documentary came out, he's been taking advantage of any opportunity possible to criticize Michael Jordan in the public. And he recently did an interview with GQ. So it seems that he blames MJ for a lot of what he's experienced as far as the lack of a legacy he seems to believe that he doesn't have, which is odd because any time players from the past are honored by the NBA, he's mentioned among them,
right.
You know, and people rarely talk about Michael Jordan without talking about Scottie Pippen. So I don't know where he's getting this from, this idea that he's not appreciated, not respected, has no legacy. But he basically said that he felt like he was used as a prop in The Last Dance. He said that the whole thing was created to glorify Michael Jordan. And he seemed to just really think that Michael Jordan was portraying him in a negative light on purpose. And the biggest issue that I had with that was the fact that the things that are coming up in The Last Dance about Scottie Pippen are simply decisions that Scottie Pippen made. And of course, you can look at that and say, like, okay, well, maybe he doesn't like the fact that they're being revealed right now or in this way, but they're not Michael Jordan's fault.
Right.
So one of the things that came up was Scottie Pippen's payment. And in the documentary, one of the things that's revealed is that Scottie Pippen was advised to not sign the contract that he signed. He was told, hey, because of the changes in the league, the way that it's growing, you might be eligible for way more money down the road. But if you sign this and you come back and you try to renegotiate, we're not renegotiating with you. It's not going to happen. So we don't recommend that you sign it. He signed it anyway. And so it's like things like that, that it's like, okay, maybe you feel like that's not portraying you in the best light. But is that Michael Jordan's fault? No.
Is that anyone's fault but your fault? I don't know. We all have decisions that we've made, literally every person, even if you're not famous. We all have decisions that we've made that we wish we hadn't had. And I think it's really difficult. We all talk about it on the podcast, like being in a public space all of the time as athletes and how difficult that is. But I mean, yeah, light being shed on that is not anyone's fault.
Right.
It's just facts.
And I mean, there was that and there was a situation with the migraines. And when it comes to that, even Isaiah Thomas, reportedly, this is something that's been, you know, shared with the public via Stephen A. Smith. But he even said that after talking to Isaiah Thomas, they talked about the Jordan rules, which were the rules that the Bad Boy Pistons came up with to shut down Michael Jordan when he was, you know, in the paint or close to the goal to stop him from scoring, basically. And they said that some of the rules actually did apply to Scottie Pippen because they felt like he wouldn't be able to stand the pressure of certain situations. And so like with the migraine game, for example, they said, you know, they believe the migraine was real, but they also believe that the stress that they put him under is what caused the migraine. That was their impression of Scottie Pippen. They thought he was that susceptible to the pressure that they put him under that he might physically become ill. You know, and so I'm like, Michael Jordan didn't put these images of you out there. These are things that are a result of decisions that you made or things that happened to you. It's, you know, they're true stories. He didn't make these things up. And I think about, have you ever seen Hamilton, the musical?
I still haven't. I'm so sorry.
So it's one of my favorite musicals. But, you know, for anyone who hasn't seen the musical, one of the things that's talked about in Hamilton a lot, and that is echoed throughout the biography that the musical is based on, was that Hamilton wrote so much that they were like, how was it even physically possible for somebody to have so many writings? And they later found out that, you know, his wife wrote some of it, like he was dictating and, you know, she was helping, but that's irrelevant. But one of the lines that comes up a lot is they say, you have no control of who lives, who dies, who tells your story, right? And so I feel like that's true and untrue in this situation. I feel like it applies here because once you go through an experience with someone, you can't control what they say or what they don't say or what they decide to include in their version of history. But since you're writing your own book, I feel like it makes more sense to focus on your own story than to try to get clout by besmirching MJ. Because in my opinion, that just makes you look even more soft. Yeah. As like, you can't even stand on your own 2 feet and explain what happened in this situation. You have to try to bring down someone who's so respected and revered in the community in order to try to sell your book. And you're trying to convince us that you deserve to be on the same level as him. Like, come on. That's, you know, it's kind of a bitch move in my opinion.
Yeah,
you know, it would be like if somebody, you know, wrote about me in a certain way. And if instead of me just being like, okay, I'm going to stand by what I did. And, you know, but here's how I would like it to be perceived. If I just start pointing fingers back, like, well, she called me a duty head. Like, yeah, it's a bad look. It's a bad look. And it's, I just feel like it's not helping. I think if he really wanted to help himself, he would take, this is one situation where I would say take the high road. Sometimes pettiness is a winner. You know what I'm saying? But this is one situation where I would say, like, take the high road, you know, figure out how to present yourself in the best light possible, because it's not like you're debunking anything anybody has said.
Yeah.
It's not like you're shutting down those myths or those stories or making us look at you any different. You're just making, you're making people hate you now. Now there are people who did respect you who are like, I don't know.
And I like what you said too, because so many, there are a lot of people who don't have the ability to control their own narrative, but when you're publishing a book about yourself, like, that is your opportunity. So use the opportunity. Don't write a book about what didn't happen or what this person did or didn't do. Write a book for you, about you.
Yes.
In the way that you want to be perceived.
And you're judging people for putting MJ on a pedestal that you feel like you deserve to be on. But if you feel like you can't promote your book without talking about Michael Jordan, are you not also putting him on that same pedestal? There's just so many things wrong with this approach. So good luck, Scotty.
Good luck, man. Do we say bitches love you?
No, no, no. I don't, we don't say that. We don't say that. Not for this. No, bitches can't respect this.
Bitches don't love this. Yeah.
Bitches don't love this. Not the move.
But speaking of things that bitches do and don't love, OBJ. So let me tell you how I stumbled upon this story today. I'm on Facebook and, you know, I see one of my Louisiana native friends and they post OBJ to New Orleans Saints. And I'm like, what? Because I knew the Saints had talked to the Browns about trying to get him before the trade deadline and it didn't work out. And so I was like, dude, you can't post stuff like this without citing sources. Like, don't get me excited, because I'm like, the trade deadline has passed. So like, how? So I go to Google it. Nothing about him going to New Orleans. But I do see that the Browns have basically said that he can't go to practice. And so I was looking at the news section of Google, and this was playing out like a soap opera. This show was playing out like a soap opera, because, you know, if you go to the news section, it shows you the most recent news stories first. And so I would like go and check every hour and a half or so and just refresh. And so first it was like, OBJ is not allowed to at practice, you know. Then the next time I checked, it was like, oh, they told the team that OBJ is essentially not a part of the team, which he hasn't been released. I don't think they're in a position where they can just release him without consequence. You know, there are contractual things in play, but they told the rest of the team that he's, you know, not part of the team. And I'm like, what do you mean not part of the team? Yeah. So whose team is he on? You know, so that happened. And then they said Baker Mayfield addressed the media and said that he was not hurt, but he was surprised by the video that was shared by OBJ's dad. Now, OBJ's dad shared a video. It's an 11-minute long video featuring times when OBJ was open and didn't get the ball. And at first I was like, did his dad really go through that much footage to compile all this? But then here's what I heard. And I've only seen one source actually report this, and I don't know why more people aren't saying it. So I don't know if it's true, untrue, but it makes a lot of sense. Because people were like, oh, if this happened, OBJ must have told his dad to do this. Because LeBron James also tweeted about the situation. He was talking about how OBJ would return to greatness and use the hashtag free OBJ. So it did kind of start to look like OBJ was orchestrating this. But someone said that this video came from YouTube and that OBJ's dad just shared it, which I could see that. I could see that if somebody is upset about the way someone they care about is being treated and they come across this video and they're like, oh man, this video makes so many good points. I'm going to share it. And boom, it's tweeted without him ever having to tell his dad anything. But so there was a video. Then there was Odell Beckham Jr. being told he can't go to practice and the team being told he's not part of the team. Then Baker Mayfield addressing the media. I was talking about this with somebody earlier and they were like, well, why was he dismissed from the team? And I'm like, I don't know. One can only assume it's because of the video that his dad shared, but it seems kind of like an extreme reaction, in my opinion. Yeah. So then that happened. And then Baker Mayfield's wife got into it. She started tweeting about it. Yep. And so, so now you have all this team drama that seems to be playing out over Twitter. And I just feel like this could have been handled better by everybody involved. I don't know what has happened between Odell Beckham Jr. and Baker Mayfield, but I think about teams like the Dallas Cowboys, for example. We've seen so many examples this season of them being so compassionate towards one another, being communicative about how much they care about one another, how much they love one another, hugging each other after games. And so I'm like, I'm not going to buy this narrative that like men just don't know how to express their feelings. Absolutely. I'm like, no, we've seen too many examples of it within the NFL this season to believe that. But I'm just like, so what is happening with, I just don't understand what could possibly be happening that's so extreme that they can't figure out a way to talk to it and come to the table as grown men, whether it's the two of them or it involves the coaching staff or the front office of the Browns. I just feel like they should be able to handle this another way. And I feel like Odell Beckham Jr. being dismissed from practice only added fuel to the fire. So I'm just like, what are you trying to do here? What are you hoping to accomplish by doing something like that? Because people already don't want you to offer his, people already don't want to offer the contractual value in order to take him onto their team. And so now you making it clear that you don't want him on your team is only going to make that situation harder. Like you're giving up your leverage. You're creating drama in the news. It may or may not be a distraction. I'm just like, what exactly is the plan here?
Yeah. What's the purpose? Where are we going from here? I like what you said earlier too, at the beginning of the episode about it being a 24-hour news cycle with sports, yes. Because now I'm like, well, what does the refresh say right now? What is it going to say in an hour? What's it going to say tomorrow? Because this is playing out right now.
I didn't want to check because our software has been having issues, but oh well, we'll go ahead and do it. I already cut out once.
We're risking it all.
Okay. I like your nails. Thank you. So now what I'm seeing, I'm not seeing anything new regarding this. The last update is from an hour ago, and it's just a reiteration of what was said earlier about or by Baker Mayfield, where he said he's surprised by Odell Beckham Sr.'s critical post. And he says he hasn't heard from Odell Beckham Jr. So here's what he has to say.
Hurt? No. Surprised? Yes. Yeah, I think there's different things that play a factor into it. I've had conversations with his dad before, man to man, face to face, and I was pretty surprised by the video and the intentions and the feelings behind it. I'd be lying if I said otherwise, but hurt? No, I'm good.
Have you spoken to Odell since yesterday?
No.
What was your reaction to the video, just in general?
I was probably just about as surprised as all of you were.
Do you want him back?
I mean, I would take anything to have a winning team right now. You know, our focus needs to be on winning.
So listening to something like that really does make it sound like I refuse to believe that he was dismissed because of a video that his dad tweeted. So that must just be the straw that broke the camel's back, because people have been talking about this sort of tension between OBJ and Baker Mayfield for a while. But it always just kind of felt to me like it was speculation based on the fact that OBJ isn't targeted a lot. And people are like, oh, but he's such a good receiver. Why wouldn't he be targeted? Well, they seem not to like each other. But there were never any direct statements, obviously, from either one of them saying, like, I can't stand that guy. Right. You know, it was always just kind of speculation, and you're reading body language, and every now and then some pundit who knows one of them would say, like, oh, well, yeah, they don't like each other. And so this must just be the last straw. You know, Baker sounded pretty vague, like, oh, well, they have some stuff to figure out. So, yeah,
this is all very messy. I feel like all of our fallouts have been just so messy.
It is. And I
kind of want to pull up what Baker's wife said, because that was pretty funny. Let me see. Sometimes they'll dirty delete that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then news outlets will be like,
got the screenshot.
Yeah. So this headline says, uh-oh, Baker Mayfield's wife has entered the Browns OBJ drama. I feel like this is when they need, like, a sassy news pundit. Uh-huh. So, like, instead of Stephen A, they just need to, like, pull up some woman with a wine glass, like, uh-oh, girl, I got the tea today. So, apparently she has been liking tweets blaming the team for failing Baker. And in response to a post that posted some stats about the difference between Baker and Hebert, this wasn't her. This is something that she liked. This is something that she liked. She said, I guess he could go hand the receivers the ball so they don't drop it, or get a stop or two against the Chargers, or block for himself so he doesn't have to play with a broken arm. Baker may not win games, but y'all won zero games before he arrived. Ever think about that? So that's one of the things that she liked. So I guess the idea that she, like, actually entered the drama is a little bit of an exaggeration.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise. Folks in the media are exaggerating for the sake of getting clicks.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, I will say I've watched enough Housewives to know that liking the tweet is a big deal for some people.
So. Super big deal. But yeah, I was already on the train of thinking OBJ needed to find another home. And now I'm just like, oh yeah, he definitely, like, I mean, they've pretty much not given him a choice. But even before this, I was just like, yeah, it might be better for him to find a place where he's a good fit. But I still just wish I understood what gets people to this point. Because in my sport, I have seen some interesting beef play out. But I don't think I've seen too many instances where a person has been dismissed from the entire team because of that beef.
That's what I was thinking in my head while you were explaining the situation. I'm thinking, who cares if they have beef? Like, who cares? If you're on a team, you have the same shared goal. And then, I mean, sometimes you hate your family. Sometimes that happens, you know? So it is interesting how, like, maybe different sports, where that dynamic plays out a little differently.
Yeah, or on different teams. And that's what I'm wondering. I'm like, did they have different goals? Mm-hmm. Is that what it was? I saw one tweet that said, OBJ wants touchdowns and the coaching staff wants to win. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of people are suggesting that Odell Beckham Jr. is a diva. He cares more about his stats than about the team.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But
I have a question for you before we move on. What percent chance do you think it is possible that OBJ will go to the Saints?
It's hard to say, because right now, from what I've heard, the Saints and the Raiders are the only teams that have interest. But also from what I've read, he would take up about $8 million worth of cap space. And it's hard to tell if they think that he's not worth it, or if they just don't have it, or maybe a combination of the two. Because reportedly, a lot of organizations don't think that he is what he used to be in terms of his receiving abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know. I can't really give it a percentage. I'm really bad at that kind of thing.
It's all good.
But I do think that he would be a good fit on the field, at least.
Sure.
Now, off the field, it's hard to say, because a lot of people are saying that he's a diva. And it's so many people that it's hard for me to believe that that's not true on some level, to some degree, even if it's not as bad. And I just feel like with a team like the Saints, with the culture that they're displaying right now, that could be a drawback.
Sure.
You know, I think they don't really have any space for that kind of thing right now.
Mm-hmm.
you know.
Be interesting to see how this plays out. I'm very curious.
Me too. I would like to see him go to the Saints because he's one of my favorite players.
I
would love that. But not if he's going to ruin the team culture.
Yeah.
And I guess that's my question for you, based on your experience in the athletics. Like, how would you weigh that? You know, if you had to choose between bringing someone on who would be a good fit, but maybe they're not as talented as somebody who's not as great of a fit. Like, how do you weigh those two things, the wins versus the team culture?
That's so hard for me to answer because I've never played a sport that made money. And no, truly. And so, like,
no,
my
totally.
I initially, like, my thought is just culture over all of it. But then I realized that my bias is towards culture because when you play a sport for, you know, the love of it and the passion for it and you're not getting paid to play and, you know, your team is, you know, not making millionaires a bunch of money, then you know, once you take capitalism out of it, then I think culture overall, but when money's involved, that's a really tough call. I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to that. I do think though, sometimes like if OBJ is a diva, depending on the strength of the culture of the team that he would go on, like that, I think people have opportunities to change. And I think that a team can change a single player. I think it's possible.
You think
maybe
so?
It's unlikely, but I do think it's possible.
Yeah.
I also wonder if OBJ were more productive coming back from this injury, mm-hmm. would this have played out the same way? Because a lot of critics of his cite the number of times that he's dropped passes that have been sent his way. And, you know, people are like, well, he hasn't even been targeted enough. If he were targeted more, he would catch more. And other people are like, no, he's dropping the ball way too much.
Yeah.
And so if he were catching those balls, if they were winning more games, if he was scoring more points, mm-hmm. would they be able to get past this? Because that's another thing I've seen is that when a team is winning, that will hide a lot of evils.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good take.
So speaking of team culture and and wins versus culture, productivity versus personality, let's go ahead and bring Electra into this conversation. So when I think about Derby and I think about the culture of the Derby community, the Derby world, especially flat track as a whole, one of the things I do think about is how it has evolved so much. But there are things that seem to have stayed the same, like this struggle in the Derby world between a person's personality and their productivity. So when it comes to the formative years of Derby, one thing that I wonder about a lot is, as you all were, you know, skating for BGGW, and even as you were skating for Texas Roller Girls, was it more about the sport and wanting to create a sport that could be competitive? Or did you think of it more as we're creating a community with a certain type of culture?
Well, that's the answer is actually both, which is kind of why we led to a little bit of a split and a rift back in the day and why Texas Roller Girls was formed. So the original formation, the BGGW, that kind of came from the sort of like the Red River district, the punk rock disc, you know, mm-hmm. like that kind of that whole thing. A lot of the, you know, original women that were the star of the first teams worked at Emo's, you know, these punk rock mm-hmm. clubs, tattooed. It was kind of like, you know, a certain genre of people that started out the whole thing. And so the initial couple of years was a struggle between playing a sport and also being entertainment, which is actually BGW was Bad Girl, Good Woman. It was roller derby entertainment, also because the term roller derby was still trademarked at the time, which was one thing. But it was, you know, we brought in music, we brought in, you know, we were part of the show, but we weren't necessarily the highlight. We brought in bands that people knew to get the crowd. And then they're like, oh, by the way, there's roller derby. And then there was a handful, you know, there was a bunch of us that actually had played sports growing up that wanted to be more competitive, that didn't necessarily care about, you know, going to Japan, which was, you know, something that came out. It was just like, maybe let's learn how to skate first and then, you know, and then we can play roller derby and then maybe we can go to Japan and do something with entertainment and all of that. So that actually was a conversation with the podcast.
Going to Japan specifically?
Going to Japan, yeah, because, well, yeah, just, yeah, because I thought we would be big in Japan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, that was, so there were, you know, so there was the group of us that, you know, that you know, I grew up roller skating. I was maybe one of a handful, like five, you know, people, ladies that could actually skate. We had actually to train Some people learn how to skate. Some people had never played any sports growing up at all, got into roller derby because of the culture that started it to begin with. But the split that did happen, which created, you know, Texas Roller Girls, and then, you know, the impetus to design the flat track. First of all, I wanted to have an accessible sport. Mm-hmm. Big track is $20,000 investment. You know, nobody has that. The DIY aspect, you know, you talk about taking the money out of it. Like, we didn't care about making money. We didn't, you know, we just wanted to buy gear and be able to skate and have, you know, our friends and family come and watch and all of that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we wanted to be, you know, considered athletes. We were training hard. We were practicing, how umpteen hours a week, whatever. You know, you have your league practices, you've got your team practices. And if you're on the all-star team, you've got those practices too. And so, you know, it's a life commitment, you know? So it's a lot of work. So we wanted to be taken seriously. So, you know, in the early years when, you know, the hype was kind of coming out, like Dave, you know, we were on a couple of shows, and then A&E had approached us to be on that reality show, you know, and we actually, you know, had to stop and think about, like, is this really what we want? Like, how are they going to portray us? And, you know, we made a decision as a league to not do that. We're like, if we're going to be on TV, we're going to be on an ESPN, you know, mm-hmm. That was kind of our goal. Be considered proper athletes, but we actually did get to be on ESPN finally, yes. After all the years later, courtesy of the WFTDA and the BBC too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's kind of a big deal for me. So,
absolutely,
and you know, yeah, so yeah.
So let's rewind to talking about the split, because
I know, great.
I feel like that was a great summary of your involvement. And so now we can dive in now that we have that background. I've only watched Hell on Wheels a few times, which for the listeners is a documentary that initially was a documentary about Texas Roller Derby and Bad Girl, Good Woman Productions. And during the filming, the split occurred. And so the split ended up being one of the focal points of this documentary. And there's one particular scene, the bonfire scene, where it seems like these people with opposing ideas about what the future of this organization should look like came together seemingly to get on the same page, but ended up being split up further than ever. Is that kind of how it felt being a part of that? Or did you kind of go into it knowing this is going to be the end of it? It's over.
Going into that.
Into the bonfire,
the bonfire of vanity.
obviously they had thousands of hours of footage and they had to get it into a 90-minute documentary.
Right. Yes.
There's so much more, you know, behind the whole thing. I mean, you know, they followed us with cameras for several years, some of us forgot that they were there. Some of us maybe should have remembered a little bit better. when you're being filmed and, you know, by the time that had occurred, there was already some mismanagement of money, you know, going into it. Mm-hmm. There was a feeling that the CEOs, as they call themselves, weren't necessarily representing the league in the entirety. They were, you know, more focused on things like I mentioned earlier, like going to Japan or like going here and making lots of money or going here and making lots of money and like being like a touring band sort of mm-hmm. thing, like, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, there was a good portion of us that were like, a community obviously formed around it. You know, we want to be considered, you know, athletes. And even the skaters that necessarily didn't consider themselves like true athletes knew that, you know, that there was that wasn't the future of the league. Like, you know, we wanted to stay. We wanted to be an Austin presence. 80% of the league basically left, you know. So there were four teams. Three of the four moved on. So all of the captains, I was captain of the Hustlers at the time. And I think Wrench was captain of the Hail Marys. And then I don't remember who else was. Anyway, we all talked to our team separately, you know, and it kind of came like pros and cons, and like, you know, there was like little, you know, murmurings and things like that going around. And
so Texas Roller Girls had already started to form before the bonfire?
We had kind of. There was kind of things going back and forth a little bit. And then, you know, and we had also talked to the team and said, you know, if
all, you know, if we can't come to an agreement contractually, and you know, are we ready to move on and start our own thing? Mm-hmm. And the answer was yes, you know. So going into the bonfire, that was actually kind of a, there was one of the team, the teams, the Putas del Fuego, that, you know, decided like at the last minute, like, oh, you know, they then they, you know, started to feel a little bit of guilt or something and felt that they had to include the CEOs. And so they wanted to have this last meeting to try to kind of bring everybody back together. But there it was already kind of almost a little bit too late. Mm-hmm. And then the person that you see, you know, Whiskey L'Amour, Lacey, that was, you know, kind of a catalyst was when we skated an event that wasn't insured. We were told that it wasn't insured and she broke her leg and, you know, was out of pocket, you know, $100,000 or whatever for surgery and whatnot. And, you know, so you rely on your bosses, or if they're going to call themselves that, to do the right thing and to insure the game.
Right.
So that was the catalyst. So that had already happened before the bonfire. So it would kind of, yeah. So to answer your question in a very long good way, yes, it had already started to kind of form before we got to that point.
It's really interesting to me that the sport of flat track roller derby grew out of all this drama, because as you said, when Texas Roller Girls was formed and y'all decided to stay on a flat track because it was more accessible to more people. And so I guess my question about that is, you know, going from an organization who at the time they were trying to save money for a bank track. So the flat track situation was supposed to be temporary, a way to get revenue in order to purchase a bank track. And then basically all this drama happens and y'all just decided, well, forget it. We're just going to stay on the flat track. So at what point during all that did you get the dimensions down and decide this is what we're going to consistently use in order to lay this track?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's, yeah, we went through a few incarnations. There were, I had looked up, maybe roller derby's been around for many years. There was, you know, back in the 20s when it was kind of like a race on like a big track. And then the 40s, like, you know, the stuff at Madison Square Garden, you know, and then again, you saw it again in the 70s. It was all on bank tracks and they were all varying, you know, shapes and sizes. So mm-hmm. I took the dimensions of, you know, something kind of in between, you know, that was a 100-foot track and then an 80-foot track. And then I kind of ended up with 88. There was a few stipulations. We were at Cleveland Skate Center at the time. So it had to fit in the skate rink.
I love that. I love that, like, roller derby leagues all over the world use the dimensions that were specifically made to fit inside of Cleveland. Like, I love that.
It had to fit in that. And then, you know, there was also speed skating going on. Quad speed skating was still pretty big at the time. And a lot of us were taking those classes. So it had, you know, so it fit kind of in that circle as well. We practiced outside, so, you know, it had to fit in a tennis court or basketball court, you know, that kind of thing. So basically, if you had a 100 by, you know, 75 foot flat space, you can lay a track and you can skate and you can play roller derby.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all you need, you know? And so those were kind of the situations. So the offset that, you know, every track layer, you know, curses me for, you know, the curb, because, you know, you put the dimensions of a, you know, a bank track down flat, and you're not going to have the same, you know, you don't have centrifugal force and, you know, inertia is pushing you out and all of that. And so, you know, just like a NASCAR track is wider on the outside, because you go in and tighten the quarters. And when we were skating, speed skating as well, you know, you go tight into the corners and you skate out. And so offsetting it a little bit, you know, that 1 foot created a 13 foot to 14 foot to 15 foot at the widest lane and going back in. So,
so it was a combination of available space and your knowledge of physics.
Yes. A knowledge of physics. Yes. Physics. Yeah.
I did it.
Now, and I was also taking AutoCAD at the time. I happened to be taking classes, because I think you should always be taking classes, but at ACC, specifically, I was going to be changing careers from hospitality and trying to go into interior design, which my mother had done a little bit of. And so I happened to be also taking AutoCAD at the time, and, you know, I never did get to be an interior designer, because roller derby then pretty much
took all the rest of the time I had from then until now.
But you get to put that on your resume.
But I did get to use it. I designed my kitchen and my bathroom and my little, you know, Airbnb space with the AutoCAD. So I used it a few times. Save some architectural fees.
Yeah, I think a lot of people listening right now can relate to that idea of like, oh, I was going to do this, but right. then roller derby took over my life.
And then roller derby happened.
When I am talking to people who are trying to do something that some people say is impossible, whether it's start a music career, or get a podcast to take off, or be an entrepreneur in any way, one of the stories that I draw upon is the stories of how the Texas Roller Girls was founded and how the WFTDA has grown into an international organization.
Right.
And I tell these people, you know, not in a disparaging way, but if you watch Hell on Wheels, that shit was a hot fucking mess.
Right.
You know, it's not how we would imagine the birth of a sport taking place.
No.
You know, there weren't, you know, a bunch of people in suits with lots of money and capital to put up and sitting down at a long table to make decisions
right.
about the future of some corporate endeavor. This grew out of a lot of drama. You know, this grew out of a lot of emotional decisions. This grew out of a lot of people making some mistakes that caused them to turn off a lot of the people in their organization and cause them to not be trusted. And so to see something like that turn into a situation where a few people were able to found an organization that is now one of the premier roller derby leagues in Texas, that is the home of one of the top 7 travel teams in the world. And a lot of those founding members went on to help create the WFTDA,
right.
which is now an international organization.
Right.
And has done what really no other organization has done, which is manage the pandemic on a global level. And you watch Hell on Wheels and you think about how the WFTDA has evolved into this organization. And it's like, yeah. So it's like, you know, the fact that you and your business partner are having a spat is kind of like, get over it, you know.
Get over it.
But for you, when you were in those initial stages, especially of interleague play and of the WFTDA being founded, is this kind of how you imagined it would go, or has it grown into something beyond what you ever thought it would be?
I mean, like I told you, yeah, it was the early years of, you know, if we're going to be on TV, we want to be on ESPN. I mean, that, you know, that was, you know, certainly excited. I didn't think it was going to happen in the global way that it did, which was, you know, obviously through the WFTDA, you know, but I was fortunate to be able to continue my roller derby career after I stopped skating. And I've, you know, been doing tournaments for, you know, traveling to Spain or like Manchester. I did the Derby World Cup for a little bit too. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I didn't think it would happen in the way it did, but there were always kind of aspirations to be on a sports network of some kind. Right. But,
okay.
And we would have figured out a way, but yeah. But then, well, I mean, in the same way, we wanted to be on ESPN. We approached ESPN early on, and then WFTD ended up just making their own sports channel. So, you know, mm-hmm. like, and then finally ESPN got, you know, we got their attention. But I mean, they have hot dog eating contests for crying out loud on ESPN, and we're just like, hey, we've got an actual sport here, yeah. you know, try us.
So how do you feel about the strained relationship between the WFTDA and ESPN now?
I haven't really been following it up as much. You know, I mean, there was, I'm not really sure the whole, where everything stands right now, as far as, you know, all of that's going on, I have to be honest with you. So I try to stay out of the derby drama just because I had so much of it early on mm-hmm. that I just kind of tried to, you know, get through it all. But I don't, maybe you know a little bit more. I don't know. Have you been keeping up with that?
Yeah. Well, in a nutshell, there was a situation a few years ago where ESPN wanted to feature some derby bouts on ESPN Ocho.
Right.
And some higher up members in the derby community did not like how some of the commercials for the Ocho were being produced. And they felt that association with ESPN Ocho would make us look like a joke. I personally disagreed strongly because the commercials didn't feature roller derby, and in all the press releases that I read, flat track roller derby was actually portrayed in a very positive light. They talked about us glowingly, but because of things like the commercial with the chess players playing chess with the bucket on their head, There were some people who thought that they were being disrespectful by associating flat track derby with other sports that were kind of a joke. So some of the sports that actually were featured were things like cornhole, hot dog eating. I think there were some esports competitions that were going on at the time because esports weren't as popular yet. My personal philosophy was that we should have taken advantage of the situation because one of the things that sometimes these broadcast companies look at is tweets per second. So I'm like, yo, if we don't like the fact that we're on ESPN Ocho, let's show that we have a community, get people to talk about us, get people to be excited about the fact that these games are being broadcast, even though they were rebroadcast of games that were already played. Yes, the derby community already knew how the ending was going to go. But if we show that we're excited about this, maybe it gets them to put us on a different program next time, you know, but there were other people who thought that it was more appropriate to speak out against ESPN, so to speak, and challenge them to view derby in a different light because of the work that we put in and how seriously we take this sport, even though ESPN themselves hadn't gotten to this, gotten to the point where I won't even say they didn't take it seriously because our games had been broadcast live before, but then they had rights to rebroadcast and they chose to also include us in the Ocho. And some people took that personally, basically. And ever since then, we haven't been included in anything involved with ESPN.
That's definitely a shame. I mean, it's growing. I mean, so the early incarnation of derby and why it didn't succeed, I think, is because there were promoters involved in telling the skaters, you know, like where to play, how to play. The skaters were treated, you know, I think they were paid like $25 a day or something like that. Like in, you know, the early, you know, the 70s years with the Seltzers when they were, you know, running roller derby. So the DIY aspect, I think, is what has kept it going so long. But, you know, and it also brings in different types of people, obviously, you know, the derby community, you know, the people that split, you know, have gone on to be like lawyers and things like that. And so there was like all these different personalities involved to try to get us all on the same page contractually and all of that. But I mean, the A&E thing was, you know, our very first, you know, we didn't think they were going to take our sport seriously either. And then they ended up filming the Big Track League. And it definitely set us back quite a few years, just how that was portrayed. So it's interesting that that actually ended up happening again, but on a much bigger level with the Ocho. You know, there are people that are sensitive. And that definitely is, it's tough.
Well, there was a scene in Hell on Wheels where two skaters are being interviewed by a radio DJ. And he says, so roller derby is basically hot chicks beating each other up on skates.
Right.
And they're kind of like, yeah, you know, which would absolutely not be a league approved answer today.
Right.
And so going back to how we talked about the evolution of the culture of flat track roller derby, one of the things that has happened is that transition from that culture of hot chicks beating each other up on skates to, no, we're athletes who train, we work out, we have a standard set of rules, we compete, there are rankings. The sport presents itself in a much more formal way now. And I think I joined during the time when that transition was happening. And what it kind of felt like was roller derby had this audience that wanted to watch hot chicks beat each other up on skates.
Right.
And then we said, no, we're not doing that anymore.
Yeah.
But we haven't really been good at replacing that audience.
Right.
What do you think about how that transition happened and what it's done to the audience of roller derby now?
I mean, I still think it's hot chicks beating each other up on skates a little bit. But, you know, it's hot athletes beating each other up. But actually, I think, I mean, I'm watching the transition. I mean, we actually got people, you know, I mean, yes, they might have come out originally because, you know, it was hot chicks beating each other up, or there was that punk rock band that they knew that was going to be playing at the halftime show or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then they stayed and, you know, and then they actually got them like, oh, wow, they, you know, they got involved in the rules and then they, you know, they had a team that they liked and, you know, so I think the audience did evolve with the sport, you know, the flat track audience at least. There still is a big track league in Austin, and it's still the hot chicks beating each other up on skates, you know, kind of thing with the, you know, the spank alley and all of that kind of thing. So there's room for both kinds of derby for sure. But I mean, I think on the global, the WFTDA fans are huge fans. I mean, I've announced, you know, 3,000, 4,000 people in a room, you know. It's, you know, in Austin, you know, we're very saturated, of course, because we have so many leagues, but, you know, internationally you go and there's, you know, these little tiny cities and towns that only have one, you know, league, that you might have to drive 2 hours to go skate, which happens a lot too. So you have to be really dedicated.
So do you think the number of leagues is what we should attribute to, or do you think the decline in the size of the audience for flat track roller derby should be attributed to the number of leagues here in Austin?
I mean, I think that's part of it too. I mean, you're definitely going to saturate your market if you're the more teams you put out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's I guess it's depending on it's you know if you have the do you want to skate at the WFTDA level and compete and travel internationally and be recognized that way, or do you just want to skate and you know meet up with your friends and you know go skate in some of those parks that we talked about earlier that you know I think you still can skate on. So.
Yeah. It's definitely two different worlds, depending on which path you choose in derby. I agree.
Here's my philosophy, and tell me what you think about this. No women's sport has actually gotten it right.
Yeah.
As far as getting the type of coverage that I feel like women deserve as athletes. If you look at women's sports and women athletes, and you look at teams and sports where there's comparable performance, so like the national soccer teams, men's versus women's, NBA versus WNBA, things like that. Even the NFL versus women's tackle football. I have seen some just outright competitive and impressive women's tackle football games. Rugby, pretty much any sport you go down the line, women are going to get less coverage than men. So to me, the issue isn't our names. It's not our outfits. It's right. that the sports industry wasn't created with women in mind.
Right.
Is that something that y'all encountered in the beginning? Like I know roller derby itself is an obscure sport. Sure. Did you ever feel like being a woman-dominated sport made things harder on top of that?
Well, yes. But the goal from the beginning always was to create a woman-dominated sport.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, I had to play on co-ed teams before if I couldn't find enough, you know, people to play on women. So I didn't, you know, a lot of the sports that I played, I didn't have an option necessarily to have an all-women's team.
Mm-hmm.
So I did want an all-women's sport, like that where women can have a safe place to, you know, to practice. In the beginning, it was, you know, and obviously it opened up to, you know, a whole community of everybody. Mm-hmm. Men are playing now as well. And of course, the junior, you know, the junior derby. To get past the, hot chicks on, you know, beating each other up on skates. So I'm like, well, we're also athletes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is tough. So you're trying to create a new sport. The original roller derby had men and women playing. And, you know, we were asked about that. Like, well, why is there not a guys team? I'm like, well, I mean, even that kind of phased out later on, even in the 70s versions, like, you know, they wanted to see the women fighting and all of that. And so that was what got coverage. So. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how that dichotomy plays out throughout history, where we just see repeatedly where society as a whole, especially in cultures where men are the gatekeepers, it's that struggle of being like, these women are sexy. They're also very competent.
Right.
Cannot compete.
Yeah.
It's like, these women are attractive. They are also athletically gifted.
Oh my God, my brain's gonna explode.
Short circuit, everything. Yeah.
I mean, you're a teacher, Jurassic.
Yeah.
And so do you ever experience that in the field of academia? I mean, like, because it's like, especially in public schools.
Well,
right?
Dress codes. I mean, I see that all the time. It's like the dress code situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, I was just thinking as we were talking, thinking about my personal experience also playing soccer and basketball as, at school age. And how it was always the men's soccer team and the girls' soccer team.
Right.
Those were the titles.
Right.
And soccer was a huge sport where I'm from. I mean, it was the biggest sport. People didn't go to football games. People went to soccer games, which I know is bizarre to Texans. But I think that was something that I was at the high school level.
Yeah.
The men's soccer team and the girls' soccer team.
Right.
And then same with basketball. Like, for our soccer seasons were separate. We played in the fall and the boys played, I'm going to call them the boys. The boys mm-hmm. played in the spring, but basketball, both genders played in the winter. And they would always have the ladies team early because more people would show up to the later one. So it was always like a 5:30 game and a 7:30 game.
Yeah,
I always wondered, why don't we switch? Why isn't it different every week so that the men play the early game and then people get off work and can come cheer on the girls? And it, for a lot of seasons, the women's team was better. The women's team was going to state, yeah, and
women's,
the men's team wasn't.
They still are,
but
in the USA.
Yes.
And it's things like that that aren't blatantly cruel treatment, but they do kind of send those subtle signals to fans, to sports viewers, that like, oh, when the men are playing, that's important.
Yes.
Right.
And when the women are playing, it's like, oh, we're just kind of letting them play, but
and,
you know, it's not that serious.
It's not to say that it doesn't still enrage me in professional sports, but it's almost like if you grow up playing sports, it's like you're just
so used to it
because it starts when you're, it starts when you're five, it starts when you're 10. It starts with how frequently the men's team gets new jerseys every 2 years versus the women's team gets new jerseys every 4 years. Like those things, like you said, they're not blatant. It's not anyone shouting, women's sports suck, but it's those little things that they just build up. And I don't, it's, they're so small to be honest that I don't think, not that they're not important, but I don't think that the men's team gets it.
No.
Right.
So
no.
That's, I think, the part that is most frustrating as a female athlete is to not, because I think that if we could get the men on our team, and we see that with the WNBA,
right,
we get the men,
especially
on our team, which
Phoenix,
like, I shouldn't need you. But if I can get you on my team, we're going to be so much better off for that. But when they do it in such a discreet way, when that, you know, sexism is so discreet, I think sometimes it's forgotten.
It's so hard for them. It's so easy for them to deny.
Absolutely.
And it's so hard for people to pick up unless you're either paying direct attention to it or you are having to deal with the consequences of it.
Absolutely.
Like one thing that we brought up in talking about the International Handball Federation, which I won't get into that, but one of the things that we were talking about is how women who play women-dominated sports, or people in general who play women-dominated sports, have to deal with the market demands of an industry that was not created with us in mind. So part of the reason that so much of the equipment that we need is so expensive, and why it's so expensive to rent space, and why it's so expensive to properly market, has to do with the success that men have already experienced. And a lot of people don't acknowledge how the success of men's sports and what that's done to the sports industry is detrimental to people who don't have the capital and the revenue to pay those same prices, you know? And it's like people, instead of acknowledging the situation for what it is, they're just like, oh, well, people just don't like women's sports. Women's sports are boring, or women are not as athletic. And that's not the case. These games are exciting. These competitions are exciting. These women work hard. But it's kind of like what the South Carolina women's basketball coach said when she said, when she got that huge contract increase, and she was like, well, it's not about the money, but it's the money that makes this situation eye-opening. And I feel like that is something that applies to a lot of women-dominated sports, where it's like, even if you don't want to be about the money, that's what's going to make people pay attention, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And so I want to go back to something that you said earlier about, you said two different things. At one point when you were talking about the founding of Flat Track Derby,
yeah,
you mentioned that, you know, money wasn't important to you guys.
Right.
And then we also talked about the fact that ESPN features things like hot dog eating contests.
Right.
And one thing about those contests is they have a lot of sponsors.
Right.
Right. So that is one of those things where you can kind of see like, okay, even if we don't feel like we need money, but we want better coverage,
mm-hmm,
we're going to need sponsors to give us money in order to get that coverage, or to market ourselves in order to get more attention. So what is your philosophy on that, and how much leagues should or should not focus on money at this point, considering the current landscape of the sports world, especially in a city like Austin, where it feels like we're getting another sports organization like every 6 months?
Mm-hmm.
I just saw a Facebook ad for a new rugby team. Like, we need a new rugby team.
Yes, there's
yeah,
a lot. Well, I mean, I did do sponsorship. That was one of the many jobs I had over the years. And in the early years, it was pretty easy, actually, to get sponsorship. I mean, we had a good marketing team. My graphic designer was like, so I'm saying, this is like these amazing women all got together to kind of, like, hey, what can you do? And, you know, so I had a little kit that I would take out to, you know, Lone Star. I mean, I had a beer sponsor. We're a professional team, you know. It's, I mean, the beer sponsors, whatever. it was took a little while to convince some of these sponsors, but then, you know, once they were in the early years, once they felt like they were getting, you know, some coverage and, you know, they carried on. But the saturation for, you know, some of these markets definitely affected what kind of money we get. So that definitely, money definitely helps, because, you know, especially getting uniforms or continuing on, you know, DIY can only work for so long. But saturation, I think, definitely affected our market as far as getting new sponsors and carrying on there. You know, we don't have a place to practice or place to have bouts. It's right. Also tricky, too, because then your only fundraising opportunity is to sell tickets. So, I mean, I honestly really wish the city of Austin would, we many times went to them to try to get them to build something. Got together with a skateboard community. We got together with the BMX, you know, like all the wheel people. And we actually had meetings once upon a time for all of that. Mm-hmm. There's lots of skate parks around in and around Austin. I don't see it, you know, where would it be? Park.
We've got a couple of tracks on the ground in a couple of places now.
Right.
But you're right. It's not like a full park. Like, one of the things that we've been wanting for a long time is something covered. Doesn't even have to have walls, just covered, because it only takes a tiny bit of rain, tiny bit of moisture to make it to where we can't practice at all.
Right.
And so it's interesting to hear that, you know, that conversation with the city has been going on for so long. But even with that, I think that's something else where money comes into play. Not saying that the city would charge us, but that would be evidence that there's interest. I think sometimes these city officials really just don't believe that it's that important to the people of Austin.
Right.
Because even though we have bouts and people come to the bouts, when they leave, are they talking about us? Do they care enough to advocate on our behalf? You know?
Well, we've had two mayors make proclamations, you know, Texas Roller Girls Day. I'm like, well, that's great. What about the other 364 days?
Yeah. You know? Exactly.
Lethemel was the first one, and Adler actually also did that, gave us a day. I mean, you know, exactly. Then I mean, we do, you know, do we, I guess we need to find, I mean, that stadium got built for, with, you know, personal money, a soccer stadium, you know.
Which is something that,
that's the thing. So like, but we're DIY, but we want lots of money, and you know,
That's the other thing that comes into play, because once you start taking money from these millionaires and billionaires, then they want to have some say in what we do and how we do it. And I think a lot of people aren't ready for that.
Exactly.
One, because like you said, or like we've all acknowledged, a lot of people come into the derby world never having played a sport before, a team sport before. And two, we get so used to the culture being what it is. The idea of somebody who not only are they, would they not be part of the derby community, but they don't even know what it is. And they would come in and try to tell us how we need to operate within the derby community. I think that is a, I hesitate to use the word scary, but I think it is a scary thought for some people, because we love what we have, you know, and we want to see it do better, but we don't want to see it changed, especially by somebody from the outside. And especially after seeing the way that they usually change things when they come in, and what people want to turn derby into. They want to turn it into hot chicks beating each other up on stage. They don't even want it to be hot athletes. Like you said, you know.
Well, we were in the early years. Yellow Rose actually offered us a lot of money, because, you know, there was a couple of girls that may have been dancers once upon a time, and it was like $50,000, you know, in the early years. That was a lot of money, and you know, but they wanted to have a team, and we're like, nope, we are not putting your Nikki Lady bikini team on here. Like, that's, you know, it's not gonna, like, and we.
Right, unless they're going to, you know, practice like the rest of us. Yeah.
No, it was they basically like, you know.
Let's just take these dancers, put them in skates. People will pay to see it.
Exactly.
And we want to maintain an athletic product.
And so that didn't fly. So
right. And,
you know, and it's like, it's hard to turn that. Like, that was a lot of money back, you know, and like when you're trying, like we were piecemealing things together. So, but, you know, we made a decision, which I think was the right decision, because then, you know, we might not still be around.
I'm glad y'all held to that standard. And I think it answers the question for anybody wondering how much we should focus on money. You know, I think it comes down to, what are your standards? You know, where do you draw the line when it comes to getting money? Because it's like, we know this world, we know there's a lot of things women could do for money when it comes down to it. But it's like, what do you want your brand to represent and to be associated with? And I'm not even saying that there's anything wrong with exotic dancing or any form of sex work. Nothing at all. But you have to admit that it's something different. We are selling an athletic product. We aren't selling sex. Right. There are some sex workers who are also athletes. Right. And that's awesome. But when they come over here, they're going to be athletes. And, you know, they're going to keep the sex work over there. We're not going to turn this into a sexualized product, even though some of us are sexy.
Right.
And it goes back to that, oh my God, these women are sexy, but they're also athletes.
Yep.
Ah!
What's happening?
We've come a long way, baby, right?
Right. And I think, you know, in the past I've said, you know, part of the issues that we have with women's sports is men's inability to process what women are actually capable of.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, that's one of those things that we can address, that we can pick at, you know, little by little, and introduce men to the idea that, like, yes, you know, we can be athletic, we can be strong, and we can be fast, and we can create a good athletic product, and we can also be hot, and we can also be smart businesswomen all at the same time.
I know.
Crazy. I know.
Crazy.
So what was the culture of the Hustlers like when you were captain and when you were a member?
So that's when we had Dynamite on there, who, like I said, was just, you know, kind of revolutionized, really brought the athleticism of the rest of the league up big notch. I mean, she was just this, you know. So then, you know, we started to train more, and the caliber of the training got better. I mean, just everything kind of came together, you know, when we realized that, like, hey, we can play this. There are more better athletes out there that can skate and, you know, and really elevate this sport a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had later on, like, Rice Rocket was another one who kind of, you know, transformed, I mean, just carried that whole thing on. We just had a few standout stars that really, you know, elevated, and then, you know, fans, of course, you know, returning fans always helps.
Now, as that was happening, and, you know, it sounds like people were getting a little bit more serious about their training and the development of their skills. Did y'all get any pushback?
From people within the league who are saying, you know, I don't want to work out this much. I don't want to this serious about the sport. I just want to keep
playing
for fun.
There's always those people, but then when they didn't get to skate on game day, then they were very upset, you know. We had attendance policies for a reason, and it was for a lot of it in the early days, it was, you know, for safety and things like that. But then, of course, there's the drama, like, later, you know, there's the star skater that decides not to show up to practices, that's still going to skate the entire game, which, you know, of course, the rest of the team might be upset about, but that's a tough call when you're getting to, like, fairness, amongst your team, and, you know, but I mean, there's no I in team, right? I mean, you might be a star out there by yourself, but if you don't have your blockers blocking for you, if you're a jammer, you know, there's other things happening, you know, in the team dynamic, that if you don't go to practices, that you do miss out on.
So out of all the ways the sport has changed and evolved, what is the change that you like the most?
Oh my gosh. Just the fact that, you know, it is played internationally now. I got to bring the Hustlers to London for the first international game. That was like the year after I retired. We did this boot camp. I mean, and the boot camp sold out. It was 150 people sold out in like 2 hours. It was the first time that a team had skated in internationally. My dad lives in London and helped Bette Noir, who was the head over there, come up with find a practice, like a place to skate, big enough for, you know, 1,500, 2,000 fans. We probably, in hindsight, should have written to the rest of the hall, because I think we would have gotten more people. So the international aspect, you know, and then the juniors, I mean, I kind of love, you know, like, that's the next generation, you know, the kids skating. I mean, it's, you know,
we've seen some awesome skaters come out of those juniors programs.
Love it. And Anne Richards, you know, the Anne Richards school, elementary school here, actually was one of their sports programs, which I think is amazing. And I would love to see that more in school. I mean, what, you know, the camaraderie that comes out of it, and the, you know, just Yeah.
So what would you like the next evolution of Black Track Roller Derby to be?
Oh, that's a tough call, right? I mean, we were kind of on the path, right? And it's been a 2-year hiatus, which is, it's tough. I mean, I don't even know, you know, I mean, it's going to take a whole year to, you know, to build back up again. I mean, I follow a few athletes online, you know, that are still working out as if they're, you know, going to be skating again tomorrow. And then of course there's the athletes that, you know, have like let themselves go a little bit. And, so, I mean, I don't even know. I mean, it's, everything's changed, right? So it's going to be tough coming out of this. I mean, the WFTDA has put out this great, you know, COVID back, you know, return to play policy, but it's, you know, hard to, you know, monitor that on a global level. Like, how are you going to, I mean, you just talked about, you know, an NFL player getting COVID. Like, how are we going to do that? And, you know, the derby, I mean, this is going to be going on for a while. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
I mean, I'd like to go back to how we were, but can I really say that? Is that is it going to? Or maybe we need to be taken back a notch.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I can't agree. I'd like us to get on the path that we were on before COVID hit in terms of, you know, the international championships that are going to take place here in Austin. We were really excited about doing like.
Every time I think about it, my heart breaks all over again.
That's because, bring it back home for the 15-year anniversary.
Yeah, and we were talking about having sort of like a little tour of some of the hotspots, you know, like Playland, for example. That was, you know, the basis of.
That's where I wanted to do. I wanted to do one of the after parties there and have like a big old disco dance party, something silly like that.
That was
going to
be so fun.
How would you describe roller derby after parties for people who have maybe never been to one?
Can I say that? I mean, that, you know, again, it's, you know, first, I mean, there has to have dancing, and like, you know, if you're not going to, if there's no dancing, then you're not going to have a good party. Mm-hmm. I mean, the early years, of course, they were crazier. And then we got a little bit more, I don't know, some of the newer skaters were much more serious and didn't go out. Like, that was a big thing. Like one of a lot of our sponsors were after party sponsors. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't show up and, you know, so it was like do it just to, you know, to make your sponsors happy. Mm-hmm. But they were, you know, much more serious. But then that's going to the international week, because they're still kind of in newer, those after parties and the international tournaments are always usually off the hook. Like DJs or drag shows and
burlesque,
you know,
dancers.
Burlesque dancers, and, yeah, that's, you know, pretty awesome after parties. Yeah. It's been some fun. And I think Montreal, I think they've thrown the best after parties that I've been to internationally. Oh, then there was actually the one in Spain. Where was that little tiny town that we played? I can't remember. That, like the north, you know, right up in Portugal. Thank you. Yeah. That after party was this little bar that was right on the beach. And so we ended up like, you know, dancing in the sand. And, you know, that was kind of a fun little after party.
Oh, that sounds epic.
Yeah.
I have been to some of those international after parties. And I think because the derby community convenes so rarely as an international group. And by rarely, I mean a couple times a year.
Right.
I think that's why people kind of like let loose in a different way. Mm-hmm. But even with going to those, I think some of my favorite memories as far as after parties is the Hot Rods stealing the Hustlers mascot.
Oh, the Hot Rods Hustlers had lots. It was the holiday part, the Christmas parties where we always have a thing, like, so that, you know, we don't get pranked.
Yeah.
Like, you know, speculums in the trees. And,
oh my God.
Yeah. That was back. That was with Bloody Mary. Bloody Mary, she worked at a Whole Engine's Health and, you know, had all these set, you know, so they strung them together and threw them into the trees or Vaseline'd our door handles. Or there was, you know, it's been, you know, pranks back and forth.
Oh man.
We used to
see, that's
party.
One
yeah.
of the things
see,
that I
mean
about
stuff,
the culture.
I know.
Yeah. That's why I don't want us to have like some millionaire owner who tells us we can't do
exactly.
things like that.
Exactly.
I'm like, no, we're keeping our after parties,
yeah.
we're keeping our fishnets,
yeah.
we're keeping our pranks, and we're
that's
keeping
right.
our names.
Keeping our names.
Absolutely.
Keep your names.
I'm not going by my government name playing roller derby. It's just not gonna happen. It's not gonna happen.
Well, to wrap up, You currently put on events, you know, you do a lot of things that involve, you know, marketing or connecting different organizations in the community, whether it's for sponsorship or collaboration. So based on your experience in doing that type of work, what advice would you give to anybody who might be listening to this and is wondering how to come back from this hiatus and help their league make more connections in their community that can help them grow and come back strong after this hiatus?
Great question. That is a great question. Mm-hmm. I mean, where do you even go with that? Well, I mean, I think always look at, you know, the tourist board. We have, you know, the Austin Sports Commission is a subsidiary of the Tourist Commission. I think many cities have a sports version, you know, like something like that, like connect with your city, get and talk to your little city, talk to your city officials, get the Parks and Rec, you know, like we have, I mean, maintain contacts. I mean, just find places to skate, you know, get the city involved, get the city behind you. Then just get your skaters behind you and just, yeah, I mean, you have to come together, you know, as everybody has to come back out of COVID together and figure this all out. So, yeah.
Have you ever observed any ways where roller derby makes for a good partner in a way that a lot of businesses might not think about?
Like as far as like getting sponsors and things?
Just like different sponsors that maybe you were able to acquire during your time with Texas Roller Girls who had to be convinced and maybe initially didn't realize how good of a partner a roller derby league is. And you put them onto some information and said, well, hey, you know, we are a good organization to sponsor, a good organization to collaborate with because of this, this, and this. And it kind of opened their eyes to be like, oh, okay, I didn't think about it that way.
I can see that. I mean, that's tricky too, because every city is a little bit different. I mean, Austin lent itself very well because it's, you know, the music capital of the world. And we started, like, you know, music was a big part of our production early on. I mean, even it still is. I mean, we have DJs still at play during roller rebounds and all of that. So, I mean, you know, you're going to have to, depending on what's the city or, you know, you live in and what kind of, you know, sponsors around, you know, like liquor sponsors or beer sponsors were, you know, an easy fit for us just because we're, you know, there's always booze at after parties or during the bouts and things like that. And we did have AT&T was a big sponsor of ours for a while. But they, you know, that was, you know, more corporate. I mean, there's, I don't know, this is a tough question.
Well, it sounds like for Texas Roller Girls in Austin, we were able to find a way to connect with the culture of the city,
right,
as it was known. Right. And so I guess even though you couldn't give the same advice to other leagues, you could say, yeah, figure out what the identity of your city is and how does your league represent that identity or portray that culture in a way that would make people want to say, like, yeah, I think you represent this city well, so we're going to support you. I think that's really good advice.
Yeah. Like, what? Yeah, it's, I guess, it's tricky. It's definitely tricky to get sponsors, though. And it's, you know, and if it's especially, you know, kind of coming out, we haven't been skating in a couple of years. So, I mean, it's a lot of people are going to be starting from scratch, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Well, anything y'all want to add before we wrap up?
My biggest burning question was where you see roller derby going in the future. And you already answered that. So, I think it's going in a good direction. I think it's, COVID definitely put us back, but maybe it'll
rethink. I mean, the thing is it's tough because there's so many different aspects now as far as, I mean, like, you know, politicizing some things or just, you know, like, we have such a diverse community now in the roller derby community. So we're having to reach out to a lot more people to be able to bring everybody back together again too. And so
this is true.
It's another tricky aspect. So, I mean, we were on a good path. WFTDA has got their things that they're trying to work out and we have to get back into tournament life again. So that means starting stats all over again and from scratch, I guess. I mean,
And they're changing the rankings. So a lot of it's going to be either from scratch or in a new way that we weren't doing it before. So it'll definitely be interesting to see how that plays out and what people decide in terms of especially like with the competitive play not returning like immediately. You know, it'll be interesting to see how that develops and what the WFTDA can do to really kind of take advantage of this time period. Because I think even though there's a lot of bad that's going on, I think there's a lot of opportunity as well to kind of say like, okay, this aspect of what we are is kind of on the decline. So we can either fix it or we can replace it with something even better. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I just think that's an area where a lot of like not only the WFTDA, but a lot of leagues can take advantage of the fact that like saying like, okay, since we're restarting anyway, we don't have to bring a lot of this stuff from 2019 to 2022 right. with us. Yeah. There's a lot of the stuff that needs to be left behind and we can come back stronger.
Right. Well, and some of those things were with the junior derby and the men's roller derby too. I mean, trying to, you know, like, I think there was a point where they were trying to do a whole collaboration with all of the leagues again. And I think
it happened for a little while.
Yeah. And I think they were starting to be on the path where we're just like, hey, you know, we can't be all things to all the people and just getting like reining it back in again and focusing on, you know, the sport that we initially, you know, created and intended for, you know, a safe place for women and, you know, or they, you know, non-binary, whatever, like anybody that's, you know, that we would welcome into the community to come and play.
Exactly. If you can't be all things to all people, decide which people to who.
Exactly.
Nail it in a little bit. Yeah. I feel like the mission was like trying really hard to be all encompassing.
Yeah.
And I think like the sentiment behind that is great, but like, yeah, can't be all things to all people. Just like bring it back in. Like what is the mission?
Right.
What is the mission?
It's like I always say, that's one of the growing pains that every sport has had to go through. And I think that's like one of the things that I really want to drive home to people who might feel pessimistic about the future of derby is that every sport, even without a pandemic taking place, has had to have a moment of reckoning with their governing body, whether that meant improving the governing body or in other sports, the governing body had to completely change. You know, I always say the NBA was not the first governing body of the sport of professional basketball. The NFL wasn't the first governing body of the sport of professional football. Same thing with the MLB, NHL, right? Things had to evolve and change. And the way that they evolved and changed had a lot to do with revenue, you know, and money. We have an opportunity still to evolve and change based on the culture that we want to create. So we don't have to get rid of the WFTDA in favor of some eccentric trillionaire who wants to run us. We are still in the position where we can say like, okay, the WFTDA, one thing we do know is it's still a democratic organization. They still have forums where they take feedback from community members. We can submit that feedback. We can vote. We can be involved in the process of what the WFTDA becomes. And I think it's up to us to be involved in that process in order for the WFTDA to become what we want it to be. Because if you have an organization that's created for the skater by the skater, and then that organization fails, you can't say this one person failed.
Yeah.
That means we all fell together. You know what I'm saying? And so I'm just like, I know we want to blame like a few people so bad. And I'm not saying those people are free of blame at all. I'm not saying that one bit. I hear the gripes. I hear them. And I totally get it. I sympathize. But at the same time, I feel like as a body, we're not doing everything that we could in order to help the WFTDA be successful. Because there are a lot of paths we could take, a lot of channels that we could go down as far as influencing the decisions that these people make or even influencing who's in those positions, right? So as far as like one particular leader, one particular member doing something that we don't like and them failing at their jobs, totally a possibility. But the WFTDA as an organization, there's no reason for that to fail.
Right.
There's no reason for that to fold right now. We still have an opportunity to do something about that. And I want to see us do it.
Yeah.
It can be a little bit pessimistic some days. It'd be dark out there. But... I have faith.
Just do it.
All right. Anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, this has been another episode of Bitches Love Sports. I don't know when this will come out because it's going to take forever to edit. But this was a great conversation. And if you're listening to it and you're like, that was a short conversation, It might be because you're listening to the free version of this episode, and there is a longer version with more responses, more information, more great stories that you can check out if you subscribe for only $4.99 a month. You'll also get access to the full interview with Hydra and access to the full interview with the founders of Violet Crown Roller Derby, which happened to be me and S-Pain, who is not here. Get well soon, bitch one. We love you. And that's it. We're out.
Bye.